From WXXI News, this is Arts Friday on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in a decision that most couples have to confront at one point or another. Do you want to have children? Or if you already have children, do you want more? What happens if something unexpected comes along? How can a change in plans bring your flaws and frailties to the surface? Your quarrels with family and more? Those questions are just the starting point for the novel All I Love and Know by author Judith Frank. She is going to be part of the Rochester Jewish Book Festival of 2014, but first, she is on the line with us on Connections for this hour. First of all, I want to welcome Judith Frank. How are you, Judith?
Thank you. I'm well. Thank you.
Thanks for taking the time to join us. Also in studio is Lori Harder, who is the Director of Cultural Arts at the Jewish Community Center of Greater Rochester and is one of the driving forces behind the Jewish Book Festival. I just promoted you, maybe, Lori. How are you?
Thank you. I'm great.
Nice to see you here. Scott Fearing is here as well. Scott's the Executive Director of the Genesee Valley Gay Alliance. Scott, nice to see you.
Good to see you again, Evan.
All right. Well, Judith, I want to start by telling you that Number one, the book is beautiful, and it opens in a very raw and sort of a wounding way for the reader to try to figure out why are they on this plane, and why don't you set the stage for us, if you could, for how the book opens, and then we'll take it from there.
Sure. I loved your description of the book, by the way. I don't usually describe it that way, but it was great, about parenting and about... So All I Love and Know is about a gay American couple, Daniel Rosen, who's Jewish, and Matt Green, who's not. And as the novel opens, they're on their way to Israel because Daniel's twin brother, Joel, and Joel's wife, Ilana, have been killed in a cafe bombing in Jerusalem. And they're on the plane. Daniel's parents are on the plane. Everybody is extremely raw and traumatized. And you're right that opening a novel with this, I knew that I wanted to open with them on the airplane on the way there, and I was thinking, wow, this is a heck of a way for people to get to know these characters. They're all completely traumatized. What Daniel and Matt know and others do not know is that Joel and Ilana requested that Daniel be the guardian of their children if they should die, and that news will be broken over the course of the first third of the novel or so and create a huge firestorm in the families among the grandparents.
I will also say, and I was telling Lori and Scott this, the novel is instantly real. This isn't a case of a couple flying halfway around the world because of a tragic loss, and there's these heroes of the novel, etc. I was instantly questioning whether I liked Matt at all, And so let me just read briefly.
Sure.
You know, Matt has to – Scott refers to him as Whiny Matt. I like that. Matt has to confront all of these things that he sort of admits to himself. It's selfish kind of to think about this, but – or maybe I should be ashamed to be thinking these thoughts. But in the midst of this loss, looking at his partner, he's thinking, well, was grief going to make – Daniel look old and shriveled? And by the way, he's already seen Daniel pick up gray hair just in the course of 24 hours. Will they ever have a decent physical life again? He wasn't going to be able to make the Rufus Wainwright concert, later that month. Oh, man, you know, I mean, all these shallow things that made me go, I don't like this guy. But then I thought, I think what Judith is doing is reminding us that that these are real human beings with insecurities and probably some limitations and frailties.
That's exactly right. I loved writing Matt because I feel as though Matt expresses everything that we actually think in moments like that, but we would never say aloud. When your partner is in some kind of crisis, when you have a family member who's in the hospital, I mean, all right, maybe it's just me and I'm super shallow, but, you know, people think about how is this going to have an impact on my plans? And they worry about that. What about my life? What about my life that's going to get disturbed at the moment? And Matt was super fun because I got to express all of that and also have him then ashamed about that very aspect of his personality. And he worries all through the beginning. Am I up to this? Am I a person who is substantial enough and giving enough to be able to handle this loss for my partner?
I also appreciated the fact that for Daniel and Daniel's family, Daniel's mom, for example, the qualm with Whiny Matt is not that they're in a gay relationship. It's just that Matt is sort of eye candy, that Matt is superficial,
right.
that Matt lacks the heft to really be part of this. And who among us haven't been in a position where we meet someone that a brother or a sister, you know, and I'm not talking, I'm trying not to speak too directly from my own personal experience, but we've all been in a position where
your siblings are listening.
No, I know.
I know that you probably have been eye candy in your time.
No. But I think we've been there where we say, you know, well, if that's what makes this family member or this friend happy, but I don't think that that works for them for X, Y, and Z. And I think that's exactly what people will relate to so well. There's so much in this book that people will relate to, but that's really what was one of the quarrels with Matt, right?
That's right. And I just want to stick up for Matt, because Whiny Matt becomes Superhero Matt.
Yes, indeed.
He is the functioning parent down the road.
Yep.
He really rises to the occasion. But that's right. Daniel's former boyfriend was, you know, sort of, he was more like Daniel. He was more cultured. He liked opera. You know, Matt's a TV watcher. Matt's a low culture person instead of a high culture person, although he's also an artist. He's a graphic designer. So he has... he seems like an improbable match for Daniel, and Daniel himself is surprised that he ended up with him.
And this is where I actually found myself really excited to feel my own transformation as a reader. I went from being annoyed with Matt, thinking he wasn't worthy, to I recalled when I became a dad, and a friend of mine who had become a father a year before, I said to him, I said, look, I said, I don't even know if I could really change a diaper, let alone know how not to break a child, you know?
Right.
And I'll never forget, my friend said, you're going to amaze yourself.
Yes.
Because you don't have any other choice, but you're going to amaze yourself. And I actually, throughout All I Love and Know, you get to see Matt maybe amaze himself and have this kind of growth that ultimately you're hoping and rooting for. And again, so relatable for me.
That's great.
You know, whether you're looking at combining closets and figuring out where things need to go and learning not to be selfish but confronting the fact that still deep down, maybe you still want to go to a Wainwright concert eventually, or maybe you still want a sex life again and all those things that are still real, right?
That's right. Yeah, I feel like the moment that I knew that I was a parent, it happens repeatedly. It's when you your child has something in their mouth or is about to throw up, and you cup your hands under their mouth to catch whatever it is coming out. Whatever gross thing is coming out of their mouth, you know, now I'm a parent, right? But that's right. He does rise to the occasion. And the conflict of the second part of the novel is that Daniel can't even recognize that. Daniel is so mired in his own grief and his own sense of loss and his own worry about safety and about just continuing with his life that he can hardly recognize the person that Matt is becoming under his own eyes.
Well, there's so many different places we can take this conversation. I will say to our listeners, again, that the novel is All I Love and Know. We don't want to give too much of it away, but I think there's a lot of different strands that I would like to pick up on. And I want to let our listeners also know, and maybe Lori can tell us about what's coming up on Monday.
Monday we've got Judith Frank. I'll be picking you up at the airport.
And
we're celebrating our 22nd year of the Jewish Book Festival, and we're really excited about that. We're going into some new directions, bringing in culture all year long, adding film, adding authors all year long, and Judith is a big part of our lineup this year. We chose Monday and Judith's book to be our community read for exactly the kinds of things that we're talking about right now. Judith's book has a really wide reach for all of us. I can't really think of anyone who hasn't had changes happen in their life that they couldn't have predicted.
Yeah, and this happens to be a dramatic one, but, you know, that's why I pegged the hour to begin with on just the question on whether couples want children. You know, sometimes you end up with a child because of an accident of nature, but sometimes you have a child because of a tragedy in these kind of tragic circumstances. So, yeah, there's so much to relate to. It's Monday night, 7:30 at JCC's Heart Theater.
Right, call 461-2000 or just go on the JCC website.
Okay, tickets $11, but $8 if you're a JCC member, and that's part of the Jewish Book Festival, which we're going to be talking a little bit more more broadly as we go throughout the hour. Judith Frank, the author, is on with us now. Scott Fearing is here. Scott, you said you think that she writes people especially gay men, really well, don't you?
Absolutely. In fact, one of my questions I was going to throw at Judith was, did you like have a gay man sitting next to you to help you put all this together the whole time? Because it really resonated with me in a way that I was actually quite surprised, pleased, and found the book to be incredibly insightful. Somebody who provides education on LGBT issues and has been looking at everything from internalized homophobia to external social cultures and family issues, you really captured things very, very well in this.
Thank you so much. I love it when gay men tell me that. That means a lot to me. it really does. I did have, I called them my native informants.
Your cultural guides.
That's exactly right. I would email them and say, so what were you guys listening to in 2003? You know, and they would confer among themselves and, you know, bring up the music that they were listening to then. And, you know, there are scenes that are more intense. There's, you know, there are sex scenes in there as well that are much mm-hmm. more intense. And that, you know, I had really pretty extended conversations with my friends about, and rewrote many, many times. I honestly don't feel as though men and women are as different as, you know, as we think they are. So it wasn't difficult creating these personalities and these people. But there were certain things that I, you know, I felt as though I really needed to get right, matters of style, of music, of sexuality, things
yep.
like that.
No, and I completely agree. I think the characters are really very universal that, again, as we've been saying, everyone can relate to. My straight brother is the stay-at-home dad. He's actually a children's book illustrator. And so he's the one doing the graphic artist and raising the kid at home.
Oh,
and
cool.
So much of the stuff that, you know, Matt deals with as he's taking on that responsibilities, I definitely saw my brother take on. And you know, even being the one showing up at the daycare, you know, being the
right.
the dad there with all the moms. And I know in your book you refer to him being the he's thought of as being the gay pet showing up with all the moms there. And
right.
So my brother, I guess, was that straight version of that.
Yeah, they also marvel at how much kudos they get from everybody for being men raising children. And
yes.
they have a kind of ironic relation to that. Like, women do this every day, and a man does it, and he's a huge superstar, right?
Yep.
Right.
So there's commentary about that as well.
Well, and again, I've got a 2.5-year-old at home. And, you know, sometimes when I take the boy out, whether we're out at a farm market or whatever, it's usually, not all the time, but it's usually myself and my son and then a lot of moms and their kids.
Mm-hmm.
And once in a while, people say, oh, it's so nice to see a dad out. And it just doesn't seem, it seems totally normal to me.
Right.
Yeah.
But again, that's why I connected with what Daniel and Matt were going through. Also, what enjoyed or appreciated was just getting out of Israel was an issue to begin with.
Right.
In a number of ways because of law and expectation and questions about impact. But when they finally are, they get nothing but, well, I say really mostly nothing but support from the local community, including gay and lesbian community, et cetera. So, but take me back to that question on just getting out of Israel. What did you as an author do to sort of make sure that you were up to speed on cultural expectations, the law, et cetera?
Well, I was writing, I thought initially that, you know, if parents designate a guardian in their will, then that would be binding. But I actually called a professor of family law at Hebrew University when I was there and talked to him, and he said, no, in fact, in Israel, what governs the decision is what the courts call the good of the child. And that really sent me on a slightly different path, my writing on a slightly different path. You know, Matt and Daniel, when they hear that, they're appalled because they can't imagine that, you know, that gay parents could be considered by the Israeli courts the good of the child. And also, understandably, the courts tend to think of that as partly as keeping the kids where they are. They don't want to upset their lives any more than they were. So they imagine themselves to be at a huge disadvantage going into the court system. And the custody battle between them and Ilana's parents, the Israeli grandparents who are also Holocaust survivors, is part of the first part of the book.
When it comes to that good of the children expectation or requirement, mm-hmm. yeah, Daniel gets sort of reflexively defensive. The quote is, "I'm sure that living with two queers is exactly what the Israeli state thinks of as for the good of the children."
Exactly.
He said, essentially sarcastically.
That's right.
But they tell him, it's not because you are gay, it's because of what impacts the kids and sort of the atmosphere around it, right?
That's right. I mean, he finds that that there are a lot of social workers in the novel who come through to do home visits, to, you know, initially to support the family and take them to the morgue, but then later to do home visits and to assess them. And my sister is an Israeli social worker, and she is very satisfied with the portrayal of social workers in this novel. Matt has an interview with a social worker who, and he's very sharp about homophobia, and he's very defensive about it. And what she tells him is that, and which relaxes him, is that basically she wants to know, you know, that he's comfortable with himself. That's what she wants to know. And once he realizes that, he's able to relax a little bit.
We're talking to author Judith Frank, who is coming to Rochester at the JCC Heart Theater Monday night at 7:30 as part of the 2014 Rochester Jewish Book Festival. The book is called All I Love and Know, and she's on the line with us now. You can join the program if you want. If you want to weigh in on what you're hearing here or talk about some of these issues, it's toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI. 263-9994. Now, Judith, you talk about a social worker being happy with the social worker portrayal, and I frankly think just about every different sort of person and background portrayed was done in a way that is more difficult for the author but is more rewarding for the reader, and that you could have just made it, the low-hanging fruit would have been, well, they're a gay couple, and therefore the Israeli government doesn't want a gay couple ever adopting, or blah, blah, blah. You could have just taken that easy dynamic, but you looked at it, for me, in a much more real way. And let me ask Scott Fearing, because you talk to gay couples, you work with gay couples who, when they're becoming parents, there are going to be questions maybe within their own families or their friends, etc. Hopefully less and less these days, but how much did you think this novel reflects realistic questions without sort of cheaply dramatizing?
I think it hits it out of the ballpark. Excuse me. There are a number of really fabulous points that Judith brings out in the book through the characters that make a lot of sense. The whole, again, question about not planning on being parents. You know, gay parents, lesbian parents are never parents by accident. It's always very planful. The only time that we're parents by accident are situations like that portrayed in the book, where somehow we are adoptive or coming into some kids that have been given to us, shall we say, to raise and for safekeeping. And that happens. I actually know a number of people in town here who have that situation. I was talking to a gentleman recently who's a gay dad who about 15 years ago was adopting, as a single man, was adopting a couple of kids out of foster care. And the social worker told the judge that the judge should not approve the adoption because, as a gay man, he should not be responsible for the lives of two young men. And the person, the judge granted the adoption, and he was so angry with Rochester in general that he left town for a number of years and just recently returned now that the kids are older and out of the school system and things like that. So, these things are not that far out of our lives. It's also odd because I'm of the generation where, you know, when I came out of the closet, one of the running jokes was, hey, thank goodness, never have to own a station wagon or an SUV. But these days, you know, there's been the whole gaby boom.
Actually haven't heard that term.
Oh, absolutely. The gaby boom has happened big time in the last decade. And so the young folks, when they're coming out, it's no longer seen as an impossibility that they'll never be parents, where really for me it was.
Judith, there's also the question obviously the book opens with the plot development that is the big dramatic tragedy. And unfortunately for our local Jewish community and Jewish community around the world, that probably feels very close to some and very emotional and very raw in real life as well. How did you want to address, kind of walk me through your process as an author with choosing to start there and to use that for in your book? And I don't mean use that as exploit that. I just mean, kind of take me through your process as an author.
Well, I wanted to write, when I started writing this novel, I knew two things. One, it was going to open with a terrorist attack during the second Palestinian uprising. And the other thing I knew was that it was going to end on May 17th, 2004, which was the day that gay marriage became legal in Massachusetts. And I didn't know what the relation was between those things. And I thought, you know, writing this book is going to be writing my way from one to the other. I wanted to write about Israel-Palestine as passionately as I wanted to write about gay life. And I wanted to see what the two of those had to say to one another. I lived in Israel for 6 years when I was in my late teens. And one of the things I'll talk about on Monday night is my family's history with Israel and our changing views of it over time. But I wanted to explore, explore you know, the way that some American Jews are ambivalent right now about Israel, people who have been, you know, brought up to love and identify with Israel, and who, you know, and especially this summer was a big moment in this, and who are sort of increasingly questioning Israeli policies towards the Palestinians. And Daniel wrestles with this throughout the course of the novel, and that's an important part of the novel for me. I have a lot of different characters in the novel. Novels never speak with one voice. A lot of different characters who have different things to say and feel different ways about Israel. But that was definitely something I wanted to explore.
And I suspect as an author that overall you do have certain things that you did want to say. Are you the kind of author who uses your work as a vehicle at times?
You know, I do, but if you try to say something political in fiction, if that's what you're using fiction for, you're going to write a very bad novel. Hmm. Fiction does not want that. It does not want to be a political statement. And my rule for myself was that any time, you know, even writing political arguments is difficult. It's difficult to write them without it seeming stiff or polemical or shrill or trying to get the reader to think a certain thing. Those things are very hard. And my rule for myself to help myself through that was that any time characters were talking about politics, there had to be something else emotional at stake. There had to be something else going on. So they had to be carrying from the previous scene the emotions of what had happened with them into this scene so that the scene would be richer than just mere puppets spouting political opinions.
Judith, broadly speaking, you really don't think fiction can be an effective vehicle for politics?
Oh, I do think it can. I think that that's not what I was saying. I do think it can. This summer, the novel came out during the Gaza attacks, and people were asking me all summer long how it feels to have it come out at that point. And you know, at first, I was thinking that just about how difficult it is to be celebrating a novel when all this human suffering is happening. And the novel's about that very human suffering. But I also started to think about, you know, the Facebook threads that I was reading where people would take these sort of outraged stances about Israel or about the Palestinians, and nobody could listen to each other. Nobody could listen to each other. You come onto Facebook with a stance, and everything you throw at your thread is proving your stance. And there was so much rage and so much conflict this summer that I really was thinking a lot about the power of art, right, in this moment, and the power of the novel to create a different kind of conversation.
I think that's well said. Go ahead, yeah.
Because novels invite you to enter empathically into, you know, psyches and ideas that are not yours, and hopefully to emerge out of the other side transformed. And that's just a different mode of political thought. It's one that touches people's hearts, that doesn't pressure them to think something. And so I really do believe in the transformative power of novels for this kind of moment.
I think especially because I don't know too many people who've jumped on Facebook and said, you know, I came on here loaded for bear with one opinion, but I've just totally changed my mind after reading somebody,
right.
You know. And sometimes,
exactly right.
Sometimes we all ought to sit down with a mug of coffee and a novel or a book, and instead of just getting on our own soapbox, you know, read absorb, reflect a little. What do you think?
Exactly right.
What do you think, Scott?
Well, what I'm thinking is that's one of the things I really enjoyed about reading Judith's book is, in addition to the Israeli-Palestinian, you know, political discussion, as it were, in big air quotes there, you're looking at issues around parenting and parenting skills. You're looking around issues of HIV and AIDS comes into mm-hmm. the conversation. Mm-hmm. Issues of fidelity and relationship. And what does it mean to maintain a relationship and maintain your individuality as well as your responsibility to the children that you're raising? And at what point, you know, again, do you become that adult and cup your hand under the mouth? And at what point do you, you know, run from the room when you have to change that mess? Mm-hmm. So I just think that you did a really brilliant job of bringing up a lot of issues that we need to think about on a regular basis that are pretty heavy sometimes.
Thank you.
Well, I would also, I would echo and say that when you look at the way Daniel dealt with or was struggling to deal with grief.
Yes.
And Matt's role in his growth and stepping up in many ways. For any couple, it doesn't have to be a tragic loss of a family member. There are times where we go through emotions, and sometimes one member of the couple will want someone to be in a mentally or emotionally different place. And I kind of alternatively found myself in All I Love and Know wanting Daniel to try to process and break free a little bit. I mean, mm-hmm. of course, it was awful stuff. But then I thought, you know, I hope Matt doesn't push too hard because, you know, I can't imagine ever being in Daniel's position. All of those things made me, Judith, think in my own marriage at times, I can be probably selfish when I try to process someone else's emotions for them.
Right. Yeah, I think the hardest thing writing this novel was writing Daniel's grief. I wanted to be true to that experience and go deep into it, the way that grief can really paralyze, distort, you know, make you rigid, make you cold, right? All the ways that grief can change you so that in some ways you're not even recognizable to your partner anymore. And at the same time, it was really important to me that readers stick with Daniel and that they be invested in Matt staying with Daniel. And I rewrote the last third of the book more than I rewrote anything. Just to keep working on Daniel, on his grief, in a way that was true to it but made it accessible to readers as well.
Here's a comment from one of our listeners, and I'll let Judith Frank, the author, handle this one. Jake says, 30 minutes in and hardly a note about the kids. Got to be a big part of the story, are they?
The kids. The kids are a big part of the story.
There are kids.
Oh,
here.
Yeah, that's right.
Thank you for bringing up the kids. So there are two kids. There's a little six-year-old girl named Gal and a baby named Noam. And Gal is a major character in the novel. And about halfway through, suddenly I was writing, and I was writing in her consciousness. And I thought, oh, hello. She wants a voice as well. And so the second half of the novel is in Daniel and Matt's point of view, but also in Gal's. She's a very, she's a quick-witted, sharp, really smart and prickly child going through a devastating situation, being moved to an American school where she's no longer the smartest kid in the class, where she feels that everything she says is inappropriate and doesn't quite fit. What happens is that Matt, who was a very queenie kid, is very attuned to that situation and has a lot to say to her about fitting in, about how it's okay not to fit in. The baby, Noam, you know, that's a mystery. Like, how does a one-year-old mourn? And he's a very pleasant child, and he's pre-linguistic in a way, and so the thing that really helped me get a handle on Noam is that I read somewhere that one major symptom of grief in babies is constipation. And that seemed to me so deep when I read that. I thought, of course they're hanging on. Their bodies are hanging on, right? Of course they can't. They're slowed down. They're sluggish. They're hanging on. And that helped me figure out how to write Noam. I mean, it also gives some comic relief because everybody's extremely, concerned about the state of Noam's bowels for a lot of the novel. There's one explosive scene in the novel. So, yes, those are the kids, and they are a big part of the novel.
nothing like, I have to be choose my words carefully. There's yeah. Celebrating certain moments. But Judith, for me as a reader, when you mention a one-year-old, how does a one-year-old process grief?
Yeah.
Again, I had a hard time reading this novel outside of my own frame as sort of a new dad, and
yeah.
And I thought about, I've been watching my son develop and change, and I thought of him around the age of one, and I thought, what if he lost his parents? And obviously it's an awful thought, because one of the really sad things is that we're sort of told, and empirically we know that that child will not necessarily remember the parents in the long term, but there definitely is there's a recognition and an emotional attachment and a routine and a need. And I thought you balanced that very well. I guess giving away too much, and hopefully that answers Jake's question somewhat about the kids, but I thought you handled that and balanced it very, very well. But it also, again, made me reflect in many ways that I did not expect when I picked up the novel.
I'm glad. Yeah, I have friends who, I have a friend who's a rabbi, was reading it and said, well, I have a 6-year-old and a 1-year-old, and this is extremely painful as I'm reading it.
Yes. Yeah, I couldn't agree more.
Yeah.
Judith, can you hang around for just a few more minutes here?
Sure.
We are due for a break. Our engineer, John Andrus, is really, really nice about when I get late for breaks, but John's about to come through the glass. So let's get our break in. We'll come back and talk more with author Judith Frank. If you're just joining us, Judith will be in Rochester Monday night, 7:30 at the JCC Heart Theater as part of the 2014 Jewish Book Festival, which is going on now. The book is All I Love and Know, and more with the author, and then we'll talk more about the festival in just about 1 minute right here on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, the music of video games, whether it's Mario Brothers, Zelda, Tetris, or more, how does it sound in a classical setting with orchestra? Rochester is going to find out. We also talk about going beyond the score, music alongside design, video, other multimedia. We're looking at those and more next hour on Arts Friday. Hello, I'm Evan Dawson, host of Connections on WXXI. Please join me for a special luncheon event with Michael Kirk, the award-winning filmmaker and producer for the PBS series Frontline. You've experienced many of his productions, exploring the issues that impact our lives. Now we'll get the stories firsthand. Join us Thursday, November 13th for WXXI's luncheon event with Michael Kirk. For tickets and information, go public at wxxi.org/events. And welcome back to Connections on this Arts Friday. I'm Evan Dawson, author Judith. There's lots of THs there. Author Judith Frank is on the line with us. And Mary on Twitter wants to know, and I don't know if Mary's read the book, wanted to know about the dynamic of couples with a Jewish member of the couple and a non-Jewish member of the couple. Judith?
That's a big part of the novel as well. Thank you for asking about that. One of the things I enjoyed in this novel is that Matt and Daniel actually pretty much have the same politics, and they believe the same things, but because Daniel is Jewish and Matt is not, they have huge arguments about them anyway. Because for Daniel, Matt having these opinions and not being Jewish is very difficult for him. And so, yeah.
So the answer is, for Mary's question, that dynamic is certainly in play in the book, and that's probably very relatable for anybody, whether Christian and a non-Christian family, Jewish and non-Jewish, all kinds of ways, again, that you will relate to some of those struggles, especially when it comes to family and expectation and those kind of things. Laura, you also wanted to make sure we mentioned a partnership. And so go ahead and mention that now, because I could get through this whole hour and totally forget. And let's not forget. Go ahead.
Thanks, Evan. We partnered with Writers and Books on bringing Judith here and for this community read. And I really want to thank them, because one of the things that we're trying to do with the book festival is reach a broader audience and cast a wider net with our universal themes that affect everybody. And Writers and Books does a great job of that. And they also do a very good job of creating community reads and getting everybody out there and unifying a very diverse community. So we've been working with them. They've been very supportive and helpful, and I want to make sure that we thank them.
Very good. And we always appreciate and love working with writers and books. And we are going to talk about some of the other events and things happening after we wrap up with Judith Frank in a few minutes. I also want, Scott, if you could just tell me a little bit about the status of not only gay adoption that we see kind of this process on All I Love and Know. There might be questions in general how it relates to American couples, whether you're going overseas or whatever the process is. What's the status now?
Boy, it still varies somewhat by state because it's usually impacted by state law. We're lucky to be here in New York State, where adoption rules and laws are pretty good for same-sex couples who are looking to adopt. But again, if you're looking at moving to another state with your children, sometimes that can be problematic. There was a pretty famous case about 3 years ago of a lesbian couple who had a child with a pretty intense medical needs, and they moved to a state that wouldn't recognize both parents. And it ended up causing a lot of problems with hospital visits and doctor visits and things like that. So it's one of those things that, you know, again, straight couples don't think about, but same-sex couples do have to consider, where are we going to be living if we're going to have kids in our life? We may not be able to take that promotion and move to another state because we may not be seen as legitimate parents there.
What could improve the process?
What could improve?
Well, I mean, is there pending legislation? Are there changes that could be on the way?
It would, again, you'd have to go to each of those individual states, and yeah, there are conversations happening in most of those. Okay. It's oftentimes tied to the marriage debate, and, you know, we saw a little bit of a setback on that today. I think the good news coming out of today's decision is it's going to force the Supreme Court to have to take a stand, and being a good civil libertarian who believes in equal rights for everybody, I think the Supreme Court, I hope that they will have a hard time making a decision other than supporting equal access to marriage equality across the country.
Keith writes to us, thanks for having this author on. What else has she written? Judith?
My first novel was called Crybaby Butch, and it's about a young lesbian in Chicago, Illinois, who is an adult literacy teacher, and an older, very masculine butch woman who becomes her student. And so it's partly about lesbian culture over the generations, the kind of interactions and conflicts that we have. And it's also about literacy. It's about what it's like to be illiterate. And it too, like All I Love and Know, involves a relationship in which one partner changes a lot. The character who is learning to read, Chris, is in a relationship with a woman who has taken care of her for her whole life, who's been the person who interprets the world to her. And as Chris learns how to read, the very basis of their relationship becomes threatened. You would think that learning to read is an unmitigated good, but it's actually true that couples sometimes break up when one partner has been illiterate and then learns how to read over time. So that's the common thread between the two novels.
Judith, later this month, we're going to convene a panel on this program about how to get your first novel published. We're going to be talking about, they call it NaNoWriMo novel. They try to write 50,000 words in November.
Yep.
And we're going to talk to authors who are either recently published for the first time or trying hard to do that.
Yep.
So before I let you go, and you've had this success, what's your counsel for people who would love to be published?
You know, my first novel was, you need to get an agent. That's one thing, that you really can't do much without an agent, except for publishing very small presses, small independent presses. My first novel garnered almost no interest from agents, and I did go with a small feminist press in the end, which I'm very happy I did. The second one, I was writing much more consciously about trying to write a novel that could be possibly published by a major press. And one of the things I did, and, you know, I'm sorry to say this, but I wrote about men instead of women. That I do think that men still count as kind of the universal subject, whereas women are somehow a specialized
population.
You know, the way
that's amazing, but if it's true, but yeah.
I think it's really true. Even and the irony is that women, of course, make up the bulk of readership in the U.S. But it's, you know how you have this category called women's fiction, and you don't have a category called men's fiction because men's fiction is fiction, right? It just counts as fiction. So I've wanted to write about gay life, and I'll continue to do so. But sadly, honestly, writing about gay men is more commercial than writing about gay women. You know, once I made that somewhat cynical decision, it fell in place as an artistic decision as well, and the whole novel, you know, built from there. But I also was much more conscious this time about readership, about, you know, I had early on in a draft, I had, this traumatic thing is happening, these men are on a plane, and I thought, well, I'll have a flashback to their life before this disaster, and I wrote a sex scene in there to show what they were like. And my partner read it and said, you know, honey, maybe this time you can let people get to know the characters really well before you start introducing the sex. And I was like, okie dokie, she was exactly right about that. So I was just more canny about readership, about what you need to do for readers. That's the kind of thing that editors are looking for. So I would say, you know, get an agent, read, you know, all of the books that you love and you think your book might be like, read their acknowledgments pages and find out who their agents were. Find out how to write a query letter. Write a really good one. Those are. But also have an eye on your readership as well.
But I think, and I don't want to
interrupt. Write about men.
I'm right about men. See, I don't want to speak for you or interpret too much, but I think what you're saying is, you have to be pragmatic to a degree, but you also don't want to completely sacrifice either your artistic goals or the purpose of what you're trying to create. I mean, I don't think it's purely cynical that you wrote about men in this case.
Yeah.
And I also think now that you've got leverage of success, that you have more of a say, that your future work will get more, you know, it gets you in the door. And sometimes my brothers who were in music for years and wanted to be on the radio, every agent and every label would tell them, well, first you got to write an easy hook and a hit song.
Right. That's right.
And then you can write what you want. But I'm not saying, I guess what I'm saying is admiringly, I'm saying all I love and know is not the easy hook and the hit song.
Right.
But there are pragmatics attached to the process of creating
that's exactly
it.
Exactly right. That's well said. That's exactly right.
Well, I do find it interesting that you wrote the novel about the dykes, the lesbians, mm-hmm. And set it in Chicago. When you mm-hmm. write about the gay men, you go to Northampton?
I know.
It seems a little oxymoronic, and for listeners who don't know, Northampton is, I think you refer to it in the book as Lesbianville or something like that.
Lesbianville, USA what is it called? The Inquirer called it.
Yeah, yeah. So it sort of caught me off guard that here are these men living in Northampton. It's a wonderful place. I love it. I've been there a number of times, but you're right. It's not exactly where I'd expect to find the gay couple.
Right. Well, I did that partly for comic effect because I knew that I need to lighten this novel in some ways. It's so intense. And I thought that, and first of all, Northampton could not be more different from Jerusalem, right? It's such a peaceful, gentle place. But also I love the idea of, you know, Matt as this stylish New York gay man living among the lesbians.
In his Birkenstocks with socks. I love that line.
Exactly right. That's right.
See, I didn't know that it was a lesbian enclave. So see, look at all the things that I've learned.
It is.
Judith Frank's book is called All I Love and Know. It's out now. It's available. And you can not only pick it up, read it as on your own time or as part of the community at the JCC for the 2014 Rochester Jewish Book Festival, but you can meet Judith Monday night, 7:30 at the JCC Hart Theater. We look forward to that, Judith, and you've been generous with your time. Thank you for taking the time this hour.
Thank you so much, Evan.
Thank you.
We'll let Judith go now, and we'll let Lori go ahead and tell us more about what's going on, because Judith is here as part of this festival, and we're in the throes of it. We're going through the 16th, is that right?
22nd.
The 20th. Oh, my gosh. I'm mixing my festivals now. I'm in real trouble. Through the 22nd. And what's going on? What, kind of broaden the scope now, Lori.
Okay. So one of the things that Judith's book also talks about is grandparents. We didn't get a chance to develop that today, but they're a big part of her story. And we have a couple of things going on with that. We have a grandparenting program next week with an 86-year-old man coming in from Chicago, Jerry Witkowski, who's going to talk about grandparenting. And he has developed grandparenting institutes at different JCCs and community centers around the country. We also have a great annual event called Beer and Books, We're bringing in a caddy, Oliver Horvitz, at the Genesee Valley Club. So we're reaching out into the community and going to different places with our authors and our programs. We've got Gail Sheehy coming here in March. That's going to be very exciting. And currently in town, we have Wendy Kaut, who is a filmmaker. We're screening her film Dorfman in Love tomorrow night at the JCC at 7 o'clock, a Saturday night screening. And she's also here rehearsing with Ralph Marento, our center stage director, for a film, a play, that's going to have its world premiere here in December called Encino in Love. So Naked and Encino, and that's going to be a great play. We've got her here for film, theater, and a partnership with Writers and Books. Wendy is doing workshops with Writers and Books this week while she's here rehearsing with the cast for the play to debut in December. So there's a whole lot going on. And today, as I speak, we have a fiction panel luncheon going on right at the JCC with two best-selling authors, Pam Jenoff and Roberta Rich. And we are also celebrating Rochester's own. You talked about local authors. We have five local authors that are appearing on Sunday mornings right at the JCC so that we can help premiere them to the community.
Joshua Dubler being one of them.
Joshua Dubler.
He was on this program last week, I think, talking about an event. And Joshua Dubler's book is called Down in the Chapel, Religious Life in an American Prison. He is a professor of, an assistant professor of religion at the University of Rochester.
Right.
And who knew? So that is Sunday, this Sunday at 11 a.m. at the JCC Auditorium. So interesting mix. Is that always part of the program to kind of bring in the Judith Franks of the world, the authors from wherever they're from, and then also to shine a light on some local talent as well?
Yes, we want to cast a pretty wide net. We want to have a celebration of local authors as much as we can. That's something that we'll be continuing throughout the year also on Sunday mornings. We're calling it Bagels and Books. We'll promote that, let people come and hear about our local authors. They're just as brilliant and creative and insightful as any author we could bring in from out of town.
How much reading have you had to do for this?
A lot.
How many books are involved in this, in the 2014 festival? Do you know offhand?
27.
27.
Total.
27 books.
Yeah.
I mean, I read a lot for this program, but that's a lot.
27 books. And then we have a bookstore that we create at the JCC that's going on right now. We take one of our auditoriums, we transform it into a cozy, beautiful bookstore. We bring in $30,000 worth of literature from Barnes & Noble. And we have a bookstore. It's a great Jewish bookstore. Come down and see us. That will be open till the 16th.
Were you surprised to hear Judith Frank say that books about women are a harder sell to agents and publishers? Maybe I'm naive. I was surprised at that.
We do see a lot more women authors. When I go to the Jewish Book Council conference in New York every June, we see 300 authors in 3 days. And there are a lot of women, but we're seeing more and more men also. And that's exciting. And we are seeing more women write about men. It is changing. The landscape is.
Were you surprised at that comment, Scott?
I was very surprised. My life doesn't allow me a lot of time, and I'm not required by my job to read 27 books over the course of a couple of weeks. So I don't read as much
you
as
don't even
I
know
should.
The books that didn't make the cut for
right.
Laurie. I mean,
right.
I bet you there were more than 27.
Oh, absolutely.
She's nodding, saying yes.
So I wasn't aware of that, but it's very surprising.
Let's check off the things we all learned this hour. That Northampton is a lesbian enclave. Did not know that.
And the market for books about women is smaller than the market for books about
men.
Yeah,
boy, oh boy.
Which is pretty darn shocking.
Yeah, that was. But
traditionally, if you want to hear about men, you're talking about sports or economics or business. So when you talk about fiction, it's really got to be captivating. It's got to be something that's really going to be interesting to you or written by someone who's already famous.
But I confess, if you would have asked me before this conversation with Judith Frank, if you're writing fictionally, whether it's gay or straight couples, whatever the plot is, if there's a couple at the heart of it, who's going to read more of the books? Women are going to read more than men.
Mm-hmm.
We know that that's the case.
That.
And therefore, the protagonists are going to be men or women. I would have said women is the easier or sort of the hookier sell.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not.
It's not. That is very surprising.
That is surprising. So when we get our panel later this month talking about first-time novel writers, we'll revisit some of these comments. And I'm going to be very curious to see what some of the writers who have talked to me about trying to break through say, because the publishing world is more difficult these days. It's harder to get published. It's harder for an agent to listen. And if I had more time with Judith, I would have talked more also about the fact that she says you got to get an agent. It's hard to snap your fingers and just get an agent too.
She's right about that. We do see a lot more authors that are self-published.
Yeah, yeah.
So that they can get their book published. Then the problem is getting it promoted.
Right. You can definitely self-publish, and we're going to be talking about that as well, because that's a viable alternative. And it used to be kind of a pejorative. 10 years ago, yeah. Self-published was like, well, I guess it wasn't good enough. That's not the case anymore. It's just the question of what's your marketing plan now.
Exactly.
So it's more difficult if you self-publish to become All I Love and Know, that successful, that well-known, traveling around the country. It can be done, but interesting conversation with Judith. Lori, online, where do we go for the full schedule of events?
Just go on the JCC website, jcc.org, or call 461-2000.
Thank you for sharing the time. Thanks for bringing in Judith Frank. That's Monday night, 7:30 at the JCC Hart Theater. Scott Fearing, always a nice conversation with you.
Always great to see you.
Scott is an educator. That's what you do.
Yep.
But the things that I learned from Scott, you never
I had to figure out what to bring to the table
today.
And so it was Northampton as Lesbianville. That's your Arts Friday lesson for the day.
Very good.
I will put that in the next brochure.
Short break, and the music of video games is where we start next hour. Stay with us.